You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, April 4th. I'm Shelby from Drake University, and here's our first story. Pottawamie County celebrating National County Government Month in April. Pottawamie County officials are celebrating National County Government Month during April to showcase how the county achieves healthy, safe, and vibrant communities. The announcement was made through a proclamation on Tuesday's County Board of Supervisors meeting, according to a news release. Counties fulfill a vast range of responsibilities and deliver services that touch nearly every aspect of our residents' lives, Board Chair Susan Miller said in the release. Pottawamie County and all counties take pride in our responsibility to protect and enhance the health, well-being, and safety of our residents in efficient and cost-effective ways. The theme for this year's celebration of NCGM's celebration is Forward Together, inspired by the signature focus of National Association of Counties President Mary Jo McGuire. The theme highlights the powerful role of county governments as intergovernmental partners that connect, build bridges to advance excellence and networks in county government, inspire driving community engagement and residents' trust in county government, and lead, spearheading local, state, federal, and tribal intergovernmental partnerships and common sense policy solutions. This year, Pottawamie County celebrates NCGM by recognizing the impact of county departments and personnel serving the community. Throughout the month, Pottawamie County will refer to the celebration with hashtag NCGM on social media, the release states. We're proud of the programs and services we provide to our residents, Miller said. This month, we celebrate the ways our government connects, inspires, and leads every day within our community and in collaboration with our state and federal partners. Our next article is Drug Take-Back Event Planned Later This Month. Communities Biannual Drug Take-Back Event is coming up Saturday, April 27th. Operation Medicine Cabinet will collect expired or unused prescription and over-the-counter medications for safe disposal, according to a flyer. The Rain or Shine event runs from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Walgreens at 535 East Broadway. Drop off medication on the west side near the drive-through lane. The drug take-back event is organized by the City of Council Bluffs, Council Bluffs Police Department, Council Bluffs Recycling Center, Walgreens, Prevention Means Progress, and the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration. I really like that article, but getting into our next one is the title is Council Bluffs, Clarinda, Glenwood, and Red Oak recognized by Tree City USA program. Local communities are being recognized Thursday for their dedication to trees and community outreach. The Urban Forestry Awards Luncheon in Ankeny will recognize cities, college campuses, and utilities on behalf of the Arbor Day Foundation and the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, according to a news release. Council Bluffs is receiving the Tree City USA Award, which requires a municipality. I'm unsure if I pronounced that right, so I will spell it. M-U-N-I-C-I-P-A-L-I-T-Y. To have either a city forester or active tree board, as well as a tree ordinance, a free planting and maintenance plan, and expenditures of at least $2 per capita for community forestry. The other Tree City USA recipient includes Atlantic, Clarinda, Glenwood, and Red Oak. Tree Campus USA Awards went to Divine World College, Drake University, Hawkeye Community College, Iowa State University, Kirkwood Community College, University of Iowa, and William Penn University. Alliant Energy, Mid-American Energy, and Waverly Utilities won Tree USA awards as well. I think that's such a great award to have in a community, and congratulations to all of those who received them. The next article is titled, Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska, Closer Than Ever to Reclaiming Land Seized by Government. This is written by Mason Doctor from the Sioux City Journal. The Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska has come closer than ever to the long-sought return of two tracts of Missouri River-adjacent land seized by the government decades ago. The Winnebago Land Transfer Act of 2023 introduced the Representative Randy Feenstra, I am unsure if I pronounced that right, so I will spell Randy's last name, F-E-E-N-S-T-R-A, of Iowa, at the end of February last year, passed the House last month. An identical bill was introduced into the Senate in November by Nebraska Senator Deb Fischer and co-sponsored by Iowa Senators Chuck Grassley and Jody Ernst, as well as Nebraska Senator Pete Ricketts. The federal legislation under which the land would be held in trust by the United States for the benefit of the Winnebago tribe is pending a potential vote in the Senate, where it is being referred to the Committee on Indian Affairs. What was really cool is that we were able to see it pass in the House. And then, a couple days later, our chairwoman, Victoria Gachayan, I am unsure if I pronounced that last name, so I will spell it, K-I-T-C-H-E-Y-A-N, Victoria testified to the Senate committee, it said Winnebago Tribal Communications Officer Garen Coons. The tracts, roughly 1,600 acres, generally referred to as the Winnebago Bend and Snyder Bend, is situated largely in Woodbury County, with a smaller part in Monona County. The land lies near the tribe's Winnevegas Casino, west of Sloan. One of the parcels is west and southwest of the casino along the Missouri River's Winnebago Bend. The second area is northwest of the casino along Snyder Bend. Originally, the land was part of the Winnebago Reservation, created by treaty in 1865, and the land was in Nebraska, not Iowa. Over time, the Missouri River shifted, leaving some of the original reservation of the Iowa side of the border, including the Winnebago Bend and Snyder Bend land. In the 1970s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers condemned Winnebago land on both the Nebraska and Iowa sides for riverbank stabilization and a planned recreation project. The recreation project was never materialized, and the tribe won a federal court decision in Nebraska that stopped the condemnation there. The court found that federal law required that any acquisition of the tribe's land must be done through a formal act of Congress. But while the Nebraska land was given back, the Iowa tracts remained in the lurch. Efforts over the years to give the land back, including a 2017 effort spearheaded by then Representative Steve King to have the land transferred to the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs to be held in trust for the tribe, were not successful. After more than 100 years on the reservation, in 1975, the Army Corps of Engineers took portions of the land along the Missouri River away from the Winnebago tribe, Feenstra said in a statement. That's why I introduced the Winnebago Land Transfer Act, which recently passed in U.S. House of Representatives, to make things right by returning the land to the Winnebago tribe, where it rightfully belongs. During this process, I've gotten to know many people in the Winnebago tribe, and I've learned about the great work they are doing in agriculture, business, and community development. From my conversations, the Winnebago tribe plans to use this land for the conservation open to the public, and I'm excited to see how they will not only improve the land, but also support our community. Under the corporation's management, the land has been used for wildlife conservation. Hunters of game and wild mushrooms have long favored the land, a relatively virginal stretch of trees, marshy grass, and sand dunes. The 2017 attempt to give control of the land to the Bureau of Indian Affairs prompted concern that hunters would lose access to the ground, despite the tribe's assurances that this would not happen. Tribal councilman Isaac Smith said in 2017 that hunters don't have anything to worry about. There will, of course, be a Winnebago Conservation Agency entering the mix if the land is transferred back in their stewardship. But expect the change in agency oversight in and of itself. A different jurisdiction handling hunting licenses and so forth, Coons said. Not much will change for hunters. We as a tribe here on the Nebraska side have a wildlife and parks department, and they're gearing up to be one of the ones to oversee that, Coons said. And to my understanding, everybody's kind of anticipating that it's going to pass. And so there's a lot of agreements in place where the Iowa DNR is going to help out the Winnebago Wildlife and Parks Department, turn it over to them, and then they'll have the staffing. There is one stipulation in the bill. The land cannot be used for casinos. The return of the land enjoys the broad support among senators of both Iowa and Nebraska. The decision to condemn and seize land from the Winnebago tribe in Nebraska was a classic case of the government walking back on its promises, Ernst said in a statement. That's why I'm fighting to right this wrong. Place the 1,600 acres of Iowa-controlled land into a trust and return it back to the Winnebago people. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was wrong to seize this land through eminent domain in the 1970s. After decades of inaction, it's time for us to make this right. My legislation will return this land to the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska, and I look forward to getting this bill to the president's desk, Fisher said in a statement. I've had many conversations with the leaders of the Winnebago tribe over the years, and I'm confident returning this land back to the Winnebago people is the right move, Grassley said in a statement. There is one tribal leader who wanted very much to see the return of the land, and who worked on it for many years, but won't be able to the fruits of these efforts. The late James Louis LaRose, who died in November at 81. He heard that it was going before the House, and then a couple days later, he passed away, Coons said. And so, it was really cool to see that he was able to hear about it. But unfortunately, he didn't make it to see it being returned to the Winnebago tribe. Our next article is titled, Casino Executive Says Online Sports Bets Won't Be on Ballot in Nebraska. This is written by Andrew Wegley from the Lincoln Journal Star. Nebraska voters won't have the chance to legalize online sports gambling this year after a coalition of the nation's biggest sports books opted not to back a ballot initiative campaign aimed at changing the state's constitution to allowing online and mobile sports betting. FanDuel, DraftKings, BetMGM, and Caesars has partnered with Ho-Chunk Inc., the economic department arm of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska, to commission a public opinion poll in February gauging Nebraskans' appetite for legalized online sports gambling, as the coalition considered launching a petition drive to put a constitutional amendment on November's ballot. February's poll showed that 57 respondents signaled support of the constitutional amendment, said Lance Morgan, the CEO of Ho-Chunk, the parent company of War Horse Gaming, which operates physical sports books in Lincoln and Omaha. But the group of national sports betting companies that helped commission the poll has declined to fund a petition drive to put the matter to a vote this November, Morgan said, which was expected to cost between $5 million and $7 million. If you're at 57% support, it creates some possibility that you could lose unless you really were to put substantial resources into it, Morgan told the Journal Star on Monday. It doesn't make any sense to go to war unless you have a war chest lined up. The coalition would have had to conduct an ad campaign and likely hire paid petition circulators to gather roughly 122,000 valid signatures, including 5% of registered voters in at least 38 of Nebraska's 93 counties. By July, to get this issue on the 2024 general election ballot. The successful 2020 bid to legalize casino gambling in Nebraska generated more than $7 million in spending by pro and anti-gambling forces on advertisements, lawyers, and petition circulators. The national companies are instead focusing on similar efforts in more populous states this year, Morgan said, while Ho-Chunk is already spending hundreds of millions of dollars on the development of casinos in Lincoln and Omaha, wasn't willing to foot the bill alone. I think we're just on a list of these big companies, I suspect, Morgan said, suggesting Nebraska was too late to the party for the companies to fund the campaign this election cycle. This is one of the problems, I think, of being a small population state, he said. It's unfortunate, I think. The national company's decision not to back a petition drive would have had faced fierce opposition from the state's influential gambling opponents, meaning online sports gambling will remain outlawed in Nebraska for at least another year, if not longer. Morgan has repeatedly called on Nebraska lawmakers to legalize online betting, a move that would remove the costly burden of a ballot initiative from the casino industry. But one of that remains unlikely in the state's conservative-dominated legislature. The industry won't have another chance to take the issue directly to voters until November 2026. Our plan is very straightforward, Morgan said. Hopefully, we can get it passed and the unicameral in the next 2 years as it becomes more sort of politically acceptable. Otherwise, I think it's almost guaranteed that it will be on the ballot in 26, he continued. But I feel bad because there is something everybody wants. And if we do it in 2026, we will be 4 years behind Iowa, and that's unfortunate. Iowa is among four states border Nebraska where online sports betting is already legal, along with Kansas, Colorado, and Wyoming. Betting on live sports was illegal in most of the United States as recently as 2018, when the Supreme Court cleared the way for states to legalize wagers on live games. In the year since, 38 states and Washington, D.C. have legalized some form of sports betting, while other states have mulled legislation to follow suit. Sports wagering was included in the three constitutional amendments overwhelmingly approved by Nebraska voters in 2020 to establish casino gambling at the state's licensed horse racing tracks. But since online gambling wasn't included in those amendments, would-be sports gamblers couldn't place sports bets in Nebraska until racetrack casinos were approved by the Racing and Gaming Commission. Warhorse Lincoln, Nebraska's first state-licensed casino, received commission approval and opened its doors in September of 2022. The casino's sportsbook didn't open for another 9 months, accepting its first bet in June 2023. Still, the prohibition on sports gambling online in Nebraska hasn't stopped state residents from doing it. Geolocation analysis conducted last year identified 64,000 mobile sports betting users in Nebraska, belonging to some users who come to Iowa to place online sports bets. Our next article is titled, Thomas Jefferson High School Student Wins National Honor Society Scholarship. Chosen from nearly 17,000 applicants, the National Honor Society is awarding $2 million in scholarships, including one from Council Bluffs. Brandon Bowen, a semifinalist in the program, earning a $3,200 prize. The program is supported by NHS's parent organization, the National Association of Secondary School Principals, which also administers the National Association of Student Councils, according to a news release. One national winner, four runner-ups, 20 finalists, and 575 semifinalists were selected. Each winner has gone above and beyond to excel academically and lift up their communities through selfless service and leadership, NASSP CEO Ron Nazo said. Their actions today exemplify the incredible leaders they are, and I can't wait to see what they accomplish. I want to congratulate Brandon on all of the service and academic achievements he's committed to the community, and I really like that article. But our next article is titled, Mail Order Pharmacy Hit with a New Licensing Board Charges in Iowa. This is written by Clark Kaufman from the Iowa Capital Dispatch. A Texas-based pharmaceuticals company sanctioned for illegally selling hormones to Iowans and facing a new round of charges for state regulators. Empower Pharmacy of Houston, Texas, is charged by the Iowa Board of Pharmacy with failing to exercise professional judgment regarding the accuracy, validity, and authenticity of a prescription drug order. It is also charged with compounding copies of federal-approved drugs that lack any clinical significance difference from the approved drugs, failing to ensure pharmacy personnel and patients are adequately protected from unnecessary exposure to hazardous drugs, failing to follow standards related to non-sterile compounding of drugs, and failing to follow standards related to sterile compounding. The actions that Empower allegedly took in violating those regulations have not been publicly disclosed by the board. However, their violations appear to be related to requirements that the board imposed on the company in 2021. In the case, the board issued a warning to Empower and it ordered it to permanently halt shipments of compounded human chorionic gonadotropin, or HCG, in Iowa. In addition, the board placed a company's pharmacy license on probation for 3 years and imposed a $25,000 civil penalty. It also required the company to submit reports to the board on a quarterly basis and undergo at least one on-site inspection. The statement stemmed from a set of charges the board levied against Empower in 2019 when it accused the company of shipping unregulated compounded HCG to Iowa patients in 2017 and 2018 rather than sending the commercially available version of the product. Typically, prescriptions for drugs are filled at pharmacies using commercially available products that have been evaluated for safety and efficacy, approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and are manufactured at facilities that are registered with the FDA. While there is not a commercially available drug product that's suitable for a particular patient, a pharmacy is allowed to compound or manufacture a product that has been significantly altered to meet the specific needs for that patient. Since compounded products of that nature have not undergone the FDA approval process, they lack the safety and efficacy evaluations required of commercially available drugs. For that reason, pharmacies are required to use commercially available drugs whenever possible. The Iowa Board of Pharmacy has claimed Empower bypassed that requirement and shipped the Iowans its own compounded version of HCG, which is a hormone, and shipped to Iowans its own compounded version of HCG, which is a hormone that supports the normal development of an egg in a woman's ovary. It is often used to cause ovulation and to treat infertility in women and to increase sperm count in men. Empower went to court to challenge the board's actions and to seek judicial review of the board's decision. It claimed that the board's investigators chose not to interview any of the company's pharmacists, any of the prescribing medical providers who coordinated the medications with the company, or any of the Iowa patients who received the compounded HCG. Polk County District Judge Celine Gogerty, I'm unsure if I pronounced that right, so I will spell it, G-O-G-E-R-T-Y, sided with board and denied the company's request for judicial review, noting that the question before the court was whether there was a substantial evidence to support the board's findings, not whether the evidence might support a different finding. In her ruling, Gogerty indicated the court was bound by the board's factual findings unless a contrary result is demanded by the matter of law. There was, she ruled, substantial evidence to support the board's findings that Empower violated Iowa law. That decision was upheld by the Iowa Court of Appeals in March of 2023. Compounding pharmacies like Empower are a hybrid of traditional retail pharmacies and pharmaceutical manufacturing companies, in the sense that they custom produce medications and formulations that are then shipped directly to patients. The custom formulations enabled them to forego royalty payments they'd have to make if they simply stocked and sold FDA-approved products. In 2019, the FDA notified Empower that the company had violated FDA regulations by failing to have on file any FDA-approved applications for new drug products it was compounding. The agency also alleged Empower violated regulations on misbranded drug products by compounding products intended for conditions that are not amenable for self-diagnosis and treatment. Our next article is titled, Citing Claims of Meth Use, State of Iowa Revokes Child Care Center's License. This is written by Clark Kaufman from the Iowa Capital Dispatch. The case originated with a September 22 complaint to DHS alleging that Lindsay, who operated Amanda's child care out of her home on Donnelly Court in Des Moines, was using methamphetamine while caring for children, and that she was allowing others to use and sell meth out of the daycare house while children were present. State records indicate that on the same day DHHS received the complaint, it sent investigators to Lindsay's home. Initially, the inspectors later alleged Lindsay failed to come to the door, but did so after a phone call was made and someone on the premises was alerted to their presence. At the time, Lindsay was caring for a 7-month-old child. Inspectors alleged that during the visit, Lindsay refused to give them access to a safe where the complaint had alleged drugs were being stored. According to the inspectors, Lindsay had said she had lost the key and forgotten the combination. According to inspectors, Lindsay allegedly told them her cousin, while not authorized to be in the house, had moved herself in and then refused to leave, although Lindsay would later deny telling investigators that. The inspectors alleged the cousin's probation officer reported that Lindsay had contacted her for assistance in getting the cousin out of the house and said that the cousin had claimed she and Lindsay had used meth in the house. The inspectors contacted the cousin, who allegedly told them Lindsay was sometimes absent from the house, leaving her with younger children who were being provided daycare services. Within days of the investigation being launched, DHHS notified Lindsay her license, technically referred to as a child care registration, was being revoked effective of October 4th in 2022. That decision was appealed, and last July was still providing child care. Lindsay participated in a hearing that involved not only her license revocation, but 5 separate child abuse assessments related to the allegations of meth in the house, and a proposed decision upholding DHHS's efforts to revoke Lindsay's license. Administrative law judge Toby Gordon ruled that last August there was significant evidence to indicate the cousin was in the house as an unauthorized household member or caregiver, which was a violation of state regulations. Gordon found that Lindsay admitted that her cousin was in her home over a period of months in the winter and spring of 2022, and he noted that the parents of one of the childs has reported seeing the cousin in the house from time to time. Gordon concluded Lindsay had allowed an unauthorized person to reside in the house and provide unauthorized, unsupervised care for a child. In his ruling, Gordon stated that in light of those findings, it wasn't necessary for him to address DHHS's parallel child abuse findings that meth had been present in the house, creating a risk for any children there. He also noted in 2020, Lindsay's self-described best friend was homeless, and had moved into her house without permission until DHHS intervened. In light of the past situation, Gordon ruled Lindsay was undoubtedly aware that a violation could put her daycare registration at risk. Gordon's proposed decision in the case was forwarded to DHHS Director Kelly Garcia. 7 months later, on March 8th, Garcia adopted the findings and issued a final order revoking Lindsay's license. That, in turn, led to Lindsay's court petition last week, seeking judicial review of Garcia's decision. The state has not yet to file a response to the petition. Lindsay and Gordon, in a Tuesday interview, does not understand why DHHS is taking the word of a known drug user in revoking Lindsay's license. "I can't believe it has gotten to this point," she said, adding that she had been providing daycare for families for 22 years. Because she is no longer a state-registered child care provider, she can no longer accept children whose care is funded through government child care assistance programs. In addition, she said, the number of private pay children can care for now is capped at 6. Previously, she said, she cared for 8 to 12 children at the time. "But so this has cut my income in half." State records indicate that prior to the case involving Lindsay's cousin, DHHS's annual inspections of Amanda's child care resulted in violations primarily related to safety provisions, such as the need for additional smoke detectors. On some occasions, Lindsay was reported to have taken an unusually long time to answer the door when state investigators arrived at the house. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, April 4th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, in Des Moines. I'm Shelby from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Again, please feel free to call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. We will now get into the obituary segment of the Nonpareil. Our first obituary is for Kathleen Binkley. Kathleen Margie Binkley was born on November 17th in 1946 in Council Bluffs. She graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1965. On June 9th in 1967, she married William, known as Bill, Binkley. Kathy was preceded in death by her parents, Raymond and Dorothy Collins, a brother, Michael Collins, a sister, Karen D. Yeager. She is survived by her husband, William, known as Bill, two brothers, Patrick and Dennis Collins, three children, Kristen, Woodward, Michelle, Brennan, and Neil Binkley, and five grandchildren, Dakota, Brennan, Megan Woodward, Caitlin Cown, I'm unsure if I pronounce that last name right, so I will spell it, V-O-K-O-U-N. Collins Binkley and Jackson Binkley, as well as honorary children and grandchildren, and beloved nieces and nephews. In 2011, Kathy and Bill moved to Florida, where their children had moved. In 2014, Bill and Kathy moved to Orlando, Florida. Kathy and Bill were longtime members of Woodland Community Bible Church in Crescent, Iowa, and Fort Christmas Baptist Church in Christmas, Florida. Kathy was an inspiration to all that knew her. While she had never sought to be recognized for her efforts, her example of quiet, confident, servant leadership was apparent. She touched so many lives along her life's journey, and we are so blessed to have had her with us. Join us for a graveside celebration of life at 3 p.m. on April 5th in 2024 at Garner Township Cemetery, with a reception immediately following at Woodward Community Bible Church in Crescent, Iowa. Our next obituary is for C.K. McAuliffe. C.K. McAuliffe, age 84, of Council Bluffs, went to join her husband, John, in heaven, Saturday, March 30th of 2024. Kay was the third daughter born to Kenneth and Myrtle Taylor, on October 28, 1939, in Council Bluffs. She was active with the Rebecca's, LAPM, and other charitable branches of the Odd Fellows. Kay worked as activities director for the Council Bluffs Care Center. She was preceded in death by her parents, her spouse, and four siblings, Joyce, Joanne, Philip, and Judith. Kay is survived by her sons, Matthew Roundtree, and his wife, Devette Walling, Timothy Roundtree, and his wife, Rhiannon, grandson, Harrison Morgan Walling Roundtree, brother, Lawrence Taylor, and his wife, Sherry, and nieces and nephews. Visitation with the family will be Thursday from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service will be Friday at 1 p.m. at the funeral home. Interment Cedar Lawn Cemetery with a lunch following at Broadway Christian Church. Memorial contributions are suggested to Midlands Humane Society. The visitation address, which is Thursday, April 4th, will be from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., is at the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home and Crematory. That address is 545 Willow Avenue in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Then the funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. at the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home and Crematory. And that address is 545 Willow Avenue in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Now getting into the sports segment. Greg Coat, Caitlin Clark, Cinderella NC State make it a great eight in crescendo of NCAA Net Final Fours. This is written by Greg Cody from the Miami Herald. Our infatuation with Caitlin Clark, the biggest thing in Iowa since corn, has grown through the years to the point she has undeniably and justifiably been the face of March into April madness in 2024. Then, Sunday night happened, and we met the heartbeat of the last Cinderella standing and the big kid from number 11 seed North Carolina State, who was delighted to watch inflict third-degree burns on number 4 Duke. There always is something soul-nourishing to see Duke fans sad, but this was extra special coming from a long, downtrodden Atlantic Coast Conference rival, and seeing the upset instigated that DJ Burns Jr., the 6'9", 275-pound senior who was buried in anonymity for three seasons at Winthrop before transferring and leading NC State to its first ACC crown since 1987. And now, the Final Four, NC State's first since 83. Burns is gigantic, a refrigerator with limbs, but with unexpected speed, deft moves, and best of all, an engaging, palpable joy on the court, as big as his frame. He arrived like the gift you don't expect. With the Wolfpack 76-64 outer of Duke pretty much in hand with 1:47 left, and time called, a much smaller reserve teammate of Burns rose to chest bump him and nearly got knocked into the fourth row by Burns' adrenaline. The sudden star of the night posed and smiled during the timeout as fans took photos. He would bop in rhythm to songs played inside the arena, and why not? Burns happens to be a multi-instrumentalist who plays piano, stand-up bass, saxophone, and tuba. Who knew? The things you don't know about a man until he comes out of nowhere to become a star on a national stage, takes Cinderella by the hand, and leads her past midnight towards the big dance. NBA star Nikola Jovic was so enchanted watching Burns late Sunday that he was late for a post-game news conference. Excused tardiness, I'd call it. The delightful emergence of Burns, who scored 29 points Sunday and Livens a newly minted men's Final Four that is legit and excellent. Big East versus SEC and Big Ten versus ACC. And the women's Final Four is just as interesting and great, if not more so. It's a fine time to be a college hoops fan or a sports fan at large as we await the women's Final Four this coming Friday in Cleveland and the men's Final Four a day later just outside Phoenix in Glendale, Arizona. Chances are now that your alma mater or chosen team is out. Chances are by now that you are drowning in an office pool of the ashes as your bracket smolders. And there's still a great cause to revel in anticipation. First, the men's surviving quartet. Dan Hurley's number one seed UConn men swatted number three Illinois from the season by 77 to 52 points and seems close to unbeatable, the reigning national champion, and favored to repeat. Only seven times has that happened, and not since the Florida Gators in 2006 to 2007. UConn has led by at least 30 points in every tournament game so far. Unstoppable? The mighty Huskers will face the football school that apparently can dribble, too, number four Alabama, by ousting number six Clemson, reaching its first ever Final Four. A long shot eventuality from a team that didn't get past the quarterfinals in its SEC tourney. On the other side of the bracket, number one Purdue continues living up to its seed, eliminating number two Texas behind Zach Eddy's 40 points. Purdue is in its first Final Four since 1980, but nobody's interloper or underdog. The Boilermakers, kids, it's an occupation before it was a whiskey and beer drink, will now face lovable underdog NC State and Burns versus Eddy. Should be a scrumptious battle of the bigs. On to the women's last four. Caitlin Clark's 41 points and 12 rebounds lifted number one seed Iowa past reigning national champions LSU and coach Kim Mulkey, decisively avenging last year's title game loss. Iowa will now face number three UConn, which advanced by beating USC in what was a seed but not betting upset. Iowa is very slight favorite, but infatuation with Caitlin Clark swaying the money. In the other bracket, number one South Carolina meets number three South Carolina State in the Tobacco Road Duel. The Gamecocks are a very heavy favorite and won national titles in 2017 and 2022. The North Carolina State and UConn have both teams in the Final Four. The same school has won both national titles the same year only twice, in 2004 and 2014. It was UConn both times. Three-peat? It was Iowa-LSU that riveted Elite Eight attention and made it the most watched game in women's college basketball history with 12.3 million viewers. It was America's darling Caitlin Clark versus the LSU coach Mulkey in about a fine-tuned, a good versus evil setup, as you will find in sports. I mean, not that broadly or with any implication beyond the two women mentioned. Clark is our national sweetheart, or at least by media nomination. And the girl next door, albeit in an all-white neighborhood, Mulkey, whose courtside outfits are louder than the crowd, is America's most unlikable coach by general acclamation, and with some cause as underlined by the controversial and thoroughly reported Washington Post piece. No matter the result, we'd either get to keep cheering for Clark or rooting against Mulkey, and that's a win for America. Our next article is titled Clark's Path to Stardom Paved by Players Who Changed Trajectory for Women's Hoops. Tom Withers from the Associated Press. Long before Caitlin Clark broke records, packed arenas across the country like a Taylor Swift in sneakers and inspired young girls to be like her, women's basketball looked very different than it does today. Until 1997, there was no WNBA. Media coverage was minimal. The madness of March was almost exclusively the men's domain. Born 5 years following the WNBA's launch, Clark has never known anything but what she'd helped create. A spectacular game underscored by a record 12.3 million viewers watching Monday's LSU-Iowa rematch in the NCAA tournament, and a sport with room to grow. While Clark has done her part with every step-back logo three-pointer, a generation of women cleared the way. And as for the Final Four wars in Cleveland this week, Clark is there after scoring 41 in the regional final to dethrone Angel Reese and the defending champion Tigers. Those round ball revolutionaries are getting a long overdue salute. More than 40 years later, Nancy Lieberman remembers Billie Jean King, assuring she was blazing trails. "She told me I was 22. You're a pioneer," said Lieberman, whose on-court wizardry earned her the nickname Lady Magic and made her a 3-time Kodak All-American at Old Dominion, 2-time Olympian, and Naismith Hall of Famer. I'm like, what? I'm a pioneer? I didn't know what she meant. I know what she means now. It's easy to forget that the 1966 U.S. Olympian team, which jump-started 2 professional leagues, played in 5,000-seat arenas during the Atlanta Games. And before those leagues launched, women were overseas to play professional. As Clark rewrote the record books this season while pushing TV viewership to an unimaginable level and pulling unprecedented attention to the women's game, she steered the spotlight toward stars who preceded her with the same deft touch of one of her down-court passes for an assist to a fast-breaking teammate. Clark had connected present to past. Before dynasties at South Carolina, UConn, Tennessee, or Louisiana Tech, there were dominant programs at Delta State and Immaculata University, the first women's national champions in 1972. Clark's run had also illuminated the contributions of some of the sports giants, greats like Lieberman, Ann Myers Drysdale, Pearl Moore, Carol Blazejowski, Cheryl Miller, Maya Moore, Lynette Woodward, and many others who laid the foundation for the heights of the game that reached in 2024. These women, whom of some have records that are still aren't acknowledged by the NCAA, have been glossed over in like TikTok times. Those are forgotten names, and they're only brought up because there's a record that is being broken where we haven't done a great job at historically producing documentaries on the history of women's basketball, said South Carolina coach Dawn Staley, who had her undefeated team in a 4th straight Final Four. "We have to do a better job," Staley added. "This day and age will be documented and sold a million times, and I hope that's being told that we pull from the legends. We're standing on the shoulders, and what they've done should not be forgotten." Maybe not household names like today's top players, who have been benefited from increased media attention the past 2 decades, and when NIL didn't mean name, image, and likeness, but literally what they received for playing, they are the ones who made everything possible. Barrier busters, and then some. "Some people play the game, and some people change the game," Lieberman said in a phone interview. "I changed the game. Caitlin had changed the game. Cheryl Miller changed the game. Diana Taurasi changed the name. Brittany Griner changed the game. And that doesn't mean you're not a hell of a player." There's a lot of really good players, but how many have really changed the game? And my, how the game has changed. Since 1972 and Title IX's historic passing, which at least in theory gave females the same athletic opportunities as their male counterparts, women's basketball has grown from a gym class activity in some places to a global game. Professional leagues from varying degrees of success started and folded before the WNBA, which has blossomed in popularity with players and teams, proudly promoting social activism and inclusion, along with playing high-level hoops. For Myers Drysdale, it's been like watching a child learn how to crawl, walk, and then run. It's hard to imagine, but it wasn't that long ago when women didn't receive athletic scholarships. In fact, Myers Drysdale, who had highly publicized NBA tryout 45 years ago, was the first to get 4-year financial assistance. She followed her All-American brother, Dave, and played at UCLA, a decision she made casually at a family cookout. David was teammates with Kenny Washington, and Kenny was going to be the women's coach, Myers Drysdale said. They came home for a weekend and said, "How would you like to go to UCLA and play basketball?" I said, "Okay." That was the extent of my recruitment. That memory draws a hearty laugh from Myers Drysdale, who was Clark and LSU's Angel's Wreaths, rolled into one. One of 11 children, she was one of one on the court, or anywhere she competed. Along with basketball, Myers Drysdale played softball, badminton, field hockey, tennis, and ran track. So gifted, she won the female version of ABC's The Superstars and competed in the men's event. During filming, she met her husband, Don, a Hall of Fame pitcher with the Dodgers, who died of a heart attack in 1993. Her flirtation with the men's pro game came in 1979, when Myers Drysdale made history as the first female to get an NBA tryout after signing a $50,000 free agent contract with Indiana. She held her own before being cut by the Pacers after six practices, but her foray on the floor with men was a pivotal moment of acceptance for women. Doors were beginning to open. "I got a lot of publicity with my tryout," she said. "It helped we didn't have podcasts. We didn't have social media. We had the local TV stations. We had local newspapers. You didn't have all that stuff they have today." Lieberman and Myers Drysdale didn't begrudge the modern player. Just the opposite. They lit the torch and proudly passed it along. When they were young, there was no professional star to inspire them. No chartered planes for road trips. No state-of-the-art facilities on college campuses. Not even the basic equipment. The late Pat Summitt, who made a meager of $250 a month when she started at Tennessee, had to fight for athletic apparel like sports bras. "We didn't have trainers or anyone to tape our ankles," said Myers Drysdale, vice president of the Phoenix Mercury. "We didn't have practice uniforms. You'd wear the same uniform 2 or 3 years in a row." For Lieberman, the soaring state of women's basketball is a testament to her generation and a new one pushing it higher. In recent years, the 65-year-old has bonded with Clark, and Lieberman finally got to see her play in person last week when she attended the Superstars home finale in Iowa City. When it ended, Clark presented Lieberman with one of her game-worn jerseys. "The greatest thing has happened to women's basketball for the next level and growth is Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, and some of those kiddos," Lieberman said. "But in particular, what this woman has done, she kind of did this. Some pioneers helped." Our next article is titled "Mosques in NYC Struggled to House and Feed an Influx of Muslim Migrants This Ramadan." Above a bodega in New York City's Harlem neighborhood, a mosque congregation hosts iftar, the traditional Islamic end of fast meal, for hundreds of hungry migrants every night during this holy month of Ramadan. In the Bronx, an imam has turned the two-story brick residence that houses his mosque into a makeshift overnight shelter for migrants, many of them men from native Senegal. I'm unsure if I pronounced that right, so I will spell it. S-E-N-E-G-A-L. Islamic institutions in the Big Apple are struggling to keep up with the needs of the city's migrant population, as an increasing number of asylum seekers came from Muslim-majority African countries. The challenge has become all of the more pronounced during Ramadan, which began March 11th and ends April 9th. Many mosques have opened their doors to migrants during the daylight hours, becoming de facto stay centers when new arrivals can find a quiet place to rest and recover, oftentimes following restless nights sleeping on the streets or in the subway. Muslim leaders say they stepped up their appeals for donations of money, food, clothing, and other supplies in recent days. "We're doing what we can do, but we can't do everything. That's the bottom line," said Musa Sinoga, assistant imam at the Masjid Aqsa Salam in Harlem. I'm unsure if I pronounced that right, so I will spell all of it. M-A-S-J-I-D and then A-Q-S-A-S-A-L-A-M. Just north of Central Park. "These brothers, they don't eat enough. They're starving when they get here. Can you imagine starving in America?" Imam Omar Nias, who runs Jamhayyadu and Saru Deen, the mosque in the Bronx, was providing a place for newly arrived migrants to bed down is the least he can do, even if it has come to a great personal expense. In our culture, you can't deny the people who come to the mosque, he said on a recent Friday, as more than 50 men arrived for afternoon prayers. We keep receiving the people because they have nowhere to go. If they come, they stay. We do what we can to feed them and to help them. The latest migrant surge has seen more than 185,000 asylum seekers arrive in New York City since the beginning of spring in 2022, with Africans from majority Muslim nations such as Senegal, Guinea, and Mauritania among the top nationalities represented in the new case in federal immigration courts and state. New York's estimated 275 mosques were among the first places to feel the impact of the African wave, as they've often migrants first stop upon arrival in the city, said Asefash Makonnen of African Communities Together, a Harlem-based advocacy group supporting African immigrants, but relying solely on the generosity of faith-based communities, many of which are already struggling to keep afloat, isn't sustainable in the long run, she said. Last summer, Democratic Mayor Eric Adams announced to fanfare a program meant to provide funding, security, and other support for up to 75 mosques, churches, and synagogues that agreed to provide overnight shelter to migrants. And so far, though just 6 houses of worship holding around 100 beds have been approved to provide additional space for more than 64,000 migrants currently housed by the city in hotels and other shelters. Well, that brings us to the end of today's readings of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, April 4th in 2024. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Shelby from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped.